There we go. Yeah, good.
Thank you, Dr. Fiore. Everybody hear me all the way back? Yes, okay, all right. As Dr. Fiore mentioned, my project or the project that I'll be talking about is self-vaccination and mass influenza vaccination events. And I'd like to acknowledge the persons who assisted me in this. Priscilla Percival, who is with the Immunization Division with the Louisville Metro Department of Public Health and Wellness. Ruth Carrico, who is with the School of Public Health at the University of Louisville, and Dr. Adewale Troutman, who is my boss and the director of the department, and also is with the University of Louisville as well. So in terms of background, the reason why we pursued or looked at this project, I think, is for reason and for information that I think a lot of us generally know. In the event of a pandemic, your charge in terms of planning, in terms of preparation, is to provide a tremendously large amount of vaccine in a relatively short period of time to a community. And in terms of your preparation, you're supposed to plan for significant amount of absenteeism. 30 to 40% of your workforce will not show up, either because they have to deal with their own family or they have their own concerns at home, or more. And then we are, gradually creeping toward universal vaccination recommendations. And even now, if you look at people who are considered high risk and specifically recommended to get vaccinated, it is the vast majority of the population as it exists. In Louisville, for me, assuming groups 6 months and older are primarily recommended to be vaccinated, that's 700,000 people that we are charged to come up with plans or processes to be able to vaccinate, and that's every flu season, if you figure that that's the standard recommendation. And I guess what got me or caught my eye in terms of this project to begin with is, if you read the JAMA article from Dr. Bob Belsha and that working group that performed the multi-center trial looking at LAIV, live attenuated influenza vaccine, nasal vaccine, they noted that 71% of the people who got the vaccine actually, and 69% of the people who got the placebo, self-vaccinated. And 96% of the time they did so without difficulty, which made you ask the question. And so to try and look at this strictly from a process point of view, we held two events in Louisville to look at the dynamics and logistics of a mass vaccination event, trying to vaccinate large numbers of people in this fashion. I will say the first event was, we didn't have the courage to open it up to the community right away, so we initially hit metro government employees, which is about 6,000 people in Louisville, and particularly emphasized first responders. These events were both 4-hour long events. They were walk-in events without an appointment, held at two central community sites. Before the first two events, we also had kind of a trial run-through with School of Public Health students, asking them what made sense and what kind of worked for us. So in terms of advertising it for the Metro employee event, we had multiple meetings with first responder groups, police, fire, EMS groups in the community, and then send mass emails repeatedly to Metro government employees. For the open event, we got radio, TV, and newspaper, basically free publicity for people who covered the story for us. Clearly an initial issue in terms of advertising this, particularly to the community at large, is making them recognize that this is not your standard flu vaccine event, that you are in fact going to be receiving the licensed vaccine, but it's not a standard process that you're going to be receiving it. And so after a few months of learning the basic ins and outs of the fine points of indemnification and who is responsible in terms of liability, talking with our county attorney's office, the county attorney's office signed off on it, and we were ready to go. This is the IRB form that we use. So we went through the IRB process with University of Louisville and really perform this as a study. And so really for the project itself, the biggest issue was the mound of paperwork that people had to sign off on before they could be a part of it. We had one big part of the room that was basically the paperwork region of the room. Then after that, when you were done, you'd come to the vaccination section of the room, and the paperwork side of the room was by far the most time intensive. And again, we had to emphasize to people that you're going to be asked to self-administer the vaccine, which is not the standard FDA-approved method of use, but this is an FDA-approved vaccine. Now, in terms of the paperwork, part of the paperwork initially is to identify that, in fact, people are appropriate for this event. So you couldn't be older than 49 years of age because it's not standardly given over 49 years of age. LAIV is not. Under 18 years of age, obviously, they're going to be self-vaccinating. We didn't necessarily want five-year-olds showing up and trying it out. And then all the other standard contraindications to receiving LAIV were also identified as well. And for people who were not to receive that vaccine, we tried to give them killed vaccine and another process, but not have them participate in this. And we just asked general background questions just to get a little bit of sense of who we were working with. Were you in the medical field? So you may have some understanding of vaccination over and above the average population. And have you gotten vaccinated in the past? So the event was staffed by one nurse, who's Priscilla Percival, and I was there. I was about as useful as most physicians are at a mass vaccination event. I moved around tables and said, thanks for coming, that kind of stuff. And then we had 10 ancillary staff, generally first and second year medical students, and then non-medical clerical personnel. And really, again, these 10 spent their time trying to get people to understand the paperwork and get them through the paperwork, which is the work part of this process. And for clarification here, the vaccine was provided gratis by MedImmune. This was an investigator-initiated study, so we went to them and asked for it. They didn't pay for any other salary or any other parts of this process. Years ago I did a couple of speaker talks for them, but I haven't taken money from MedImmune for years, just for perfect clarification on that point. One of my regrets here is Ms. Percival, Priscilla, who's the nurse who really did everything, because of our financial situation in Metro government, getting travel money is almost out of the question. My hope would be we could give you the next best thing. And what I hope to do here is, you can watch this. This is basically a run through of how she did this and what she did in terms of educating people.
Okay? And then at the count of three, one, two, three, we will push, okay? Then you will grasp it, and there's a little, like a pulse pin on the bottom of it. You'll take that off, lay that on the table, insert it in the other nostril, one, two, three, push, all right? The only thing that we might do in between is we probably will dab our nose, okay? You don't need to sniff, you don't need to snort, okay? It's a mist that's going to go in the mucous membrane, but you might have the urge to dab, okay? So now everybody, pick up your plunger in one hand and a Kleenex in the other. Okay, does everybody have it? All right. The first thing that we're going to do is into your right nostril, insert the plunger. Yeah, take the tip off. Okay. One, two, three, push. Take it out, dab. Into the left nostril. Oh, take the little cloth pin off. It pinch it off. Okay, left nostril, one, two, three, push, and down. Take the plunger and put it in the paper bag on your, okay? Clean your hands off again. And then if you will come finally fill out the post-test for us. I think there's three or four yes or no questions. And then you may exit out this door, right?
So I, whether, yeah. Now, whether that one lady would have subjected herself to this if she realized her nostril was going to be like 8 feet tall in front of you, that's a different question. Second. Overall results we got out of this. The total of the two four-hour events, we vaccinated a total of 224 people. Now, to be honest, one of the things they couldn't really get across to you is how actually boring this event was, because if you looked at that number of people, that's like 18, 20 people, and it's about 2 minutes at a shot, so to speak. And so 224 people were, you know, we had, like I said, I had the 10 volunteers. We sent them all home about half an hour in because it was so fast. We did 49 people in the first hour of the second event. And again, it's really that was two groups taking 2 minutes apiece. Of them, 19% of the people who participated had a medical background. 29% reported never having received a vaccine previously. Out of the 226 people, two of them were not able to participate. One of them showed up and had an anxiety disorder, announced to us, "I have a bad anxiety disorder," and said, "Well, maybe you're not okay to go forward with this." And the other person had a neuromuscular disorder, and so she really wasn't able to do the dexterity in order to use the vaccine. And questioning people afterwards, 2.7% of people reported side effects of vaccination. So did you have side effects? People who said yes, we gave them comment time. And of course, it's right after the event, basically the biggest thing is the stuff stuffed up my nose or it ran down my nose, and that was it. In terms of significant serious medical events, that simply didn't happen. 96% felt they used the vaccine correctly, and 96% said that, yes, self-administering in the future would be worthwhile to them. So lessons learned. To be honest, it's the same issue we've run into year after year in terms of flu vaccine. Getting healthy 18 to 49-year-olds to show up for flu vaccine is just not the easiest thing to do. Initial communication of the eligibility criteria is vital. 18 to 49 healthy people, you can imagine we have people who show up who either are not in that age group or have underlying risks that, they want to get vaccinated, but no, you can't participate. So in terms of difficulties, that was probably the difficulty that people showed up that we had to find, kill the vaccine for. In terms of lessons, Priscilla, she's a registered nurse, but really as a health educator was probably her primary mission here. So if you're good at that, it makes the whole process go a lot easier. You wouldn't necessarily want to have just any person out there trying to educate. People may not be comfortable with that. You may have noticed at the end, biggest thing we learned with the School of Public Health students is you got to have a whole lot of tissue, hand sanitizer, and table cleaner because, you got a live virus that's kind of floating around. People aren't really enthused about that. And so you have to have a process to clean themselves up and clean up the tables quickly to make everybody comfortable. In terms of messaging, it was about as easy as that for just about all the people that we work with. We had to tell the participants to spray hard. You have to generate the mist, So that was probably the biggest message that we had to work through and emphasize. In terms of a process, administration or mass administration or educating people to self-vaccinate all at the same time is very practical and extremely doable. And, I feel pretty comfortable that we could have done a vast multiple numbers higher than we see. In fact, we had hundreds of more doses that we'd ordered. The process could take that sort of strain. I think it is important to recognize, the limits of what we're talking about here. We did not follow up with people to say, did you actually get the vaccine or not? This was not an event to demonstrate the efficacy or effectiveness of this vaccine. I mean, so you have to take it, for what it is. And, you know, before you'll go home and say, most people in Louisville are crazy, man. They're just having everybody self-vaccinate in their pandemic plan. You know, it's like Lord of the Flies with thimerosal. I mean, it's not going to be like that. We're doing exactly what other health departments are doing, which is developing our medical reserve corps. We have our points of distribution site, and we're working through those plans. This is not plan A. This is plan F, plan G. But, you know, anybody who's been involved in emergency preparedness in these processes is, you know, you have to be prepared for nth horrible scenario. And anybody who's had an emergency preparedness event and relied on your medical reserve corps to come and found how few of the medical reserve corps showed up, even though you had hundreds and hundreds or 1,000 people, recognizes that it's nice to have something where you can say, we can vaccinate a large number of people in a hurry. Now, early on, I'd mentioned that MedImmune, in their study, had noted that somewhere around 70% of people had self-vaccinated in the trial for effectiveness. So that's, you know, some evidence of efficacy. At the same time, I'd asked them about it, and you know, they'd said, "Well, we're not prepared to say that this is essentially entirely equivalent." So there does remain the question of efficacy in a situation, you know, where people are self-vaccinating. I think that has to be looked at in a more formal process before you decide that, you know, this is definitely, you know, a certain method that you could go forward using. That's what I got.
Well, thanks. That was great, and it even left us some time for a panel discussion up here. We can take some questions at the mic. So Matt will come back up, and Tiffany Tate and Mark Sawyer will join us. And please do provide questions for our excellent panel.
Hi, this is Farooq Ahmed, CDC. I had a question about the declination statement. You know, the process of signing the declination statement can be made easy or it can be made difficult. You know, if you sign it on the intranet or fill out the form and send it, that's easy. But I have talked to some hospitals with influenza vaccination rates for their healthcare staff that is over 90%. And they make it really difficult to sign the declination form. You know, they have to go sign it face to face with the person who's running the immunization program. So, and that person is the immunization champion. So there's an opportunity to educate. So if they say that this will make me sick, you know, the person or the response would be, we looked at the data for last year and no one got sick. And also, they will have to take a class before they can sign, you know, the declination form. And also there's other sorts of pressure, like peer pressure. So the unit with the highest vaccination rate would get, let's say, 2 weeks of casual dress where they can wear, you know, jeans. And that's a big deal for those, you know, staff. And so there's a peer pressure that if you are not getting the vaccine, then the whole unit, you know, does not get to wear jeans, you know, that type of thing.
Yeah. I have a little trouble hearing because of the echo here, but I think your comments are very well taken, that the vigor with which people discourage the declination and make it difficult to sign certainly plays a role. And having an immunization champion in your hospital to really go out of their way to educate the staff about the value of influenza immunization and try to debunk the myths that the healthcare workers hold is certainly an important part of the program. And our observations in San Diego is that that was quite variable across the hospitals.
Hi, I'm J.R. Ransom with the National Association of County and City Health Officials. I had a question for each presenter. For Mark and Tiffany, I was wondering what was the interaction with unions in terms of the declination and getting healthcare workers to participate in a vaccination program and what those negotiations looked like and what their attitudes were. And for Matt, I'm wondering what was the attitude of local providers about people self-vaccinating and comments about modified standards of care during an emergency. Any plans to expand this to look at having those 18 to 49-year-olds who do self-vaccinate participate in vaccinating family members who may be younger but eligible for flu mist? And if you could comment on that.
I'll go first because mine is a quick answer. We haven't gotten involved at the facility level with the declination forms. We don't have a really strong, we strongly encourage the use of declination forms, but we haven't gotten involved to the point that unions would be a union issue.
And just to say, the California experience is there really wasn't much in the way of negotiations since it was a state law. There really wasn't a lot that the unions could do about it. And as I mentioned, there really wasn't much in the way of enforcement for anyone who didn't sign the declination. That might be where the union might step up if somebody was actually terminated as a result of a hospital policy to not sign the declination. We haven't seen that carried out, so I'm not sure we've run the test yet.
JR, for a couple answers to the two questions. The first, in terms of providers, to be true, there are so many different sites that you can get flu vaccine out in the community. I think providers looked at it as one more potential, site. I think that they have the same experience that we have, which is that 18 to 49-year-olds just don't show up to get vaccinated all that often. And so in terms of follow-up, to be honest, I told people that I was going to present it here and decide how crazy people thought we were for doing this in terms of whether we're going to go any further with this. I mean, it's definitely a modified standard of care. And so you can only, there's limits to the distance that you can go in terms of doing that before you demonstrate efficacy of the vaccine. I think there are natural ways to look at it. First responders and college students and larger groups of people, you can get together all at one time, and the potential for them to be able to mass vaccinate with very few numbers of people, I think that's kind of an obvious next thing to move forward toward. Having a train the trainer event where someone gets vaccinated and then vaccinates other people. That's a bold statement. I'm not sure I'm ready to get to that one yet. But your point is well taken, or at least to me, which is that it's not brain surgery vaccinating yourself. And if you have a tremendous number of people that you need to get vaccinated, and you know that the infrastructure to do it, business as usual, is necessarily going to hold, you have to think about other ways to pursue it.
Hi, Andrea Kroll from the National Vaccine Program Office. And my question is for the first two speakers, and it's specifically about definitions. The first definition is healthcare worker. In the case of the Maryland experience, you defined or attempted to define the problem with healthcare workers or the definition of it. So I was wondering if the definition of healthcare worker was addressed in the San Diego scenario. And then the second definition is an employee. And I just wanted to know if that was considered in the narrow definition of employee, meaning someone who was paid from that facility, or was it defined more broadly to mean anyone who provide a service at that facility, regardless of whether they were paid, non-paid, or actually, worked for that employee or just provided the service there? Thank you.
In the case of Maryland, the definition of employee has evolved throughout this initiative. Excuse me. The first year we said employees. The next year we said employees and volunteers. This year we said employees, volunteers, and contractors. So each year it has expanded. Anyone who's in the facility providing a service or sharing the air with a patient.
The definition of a healthcare worker in our consortium was individuals who had direct patient contact as part of their routine daily activities. That was a consensus definition across the hospitals in the partnership. The state law at first was interpreted as applying to employees, that is, individuals who received their paycheck from the hospital, but as this process has evolved, there's a commission that is turning the details of the law into regulation, and they've now gradually expanded that. And so for this last year, that the expansion has now included independent practitioners associated with a hospital, the physicians on the medical staff being the largest group of those. And so they, too, are subject to this declination process.
Hi, Janet from Reno. My question is for Dr. Zahn. First of all, you're looking at a self-vaccinator. I don't trust anyone else to do it swift enough to get that good mist.
We're out there, right? We know who you are.
Yeah. It's too easy, you know? It's just too easy to get it done, yeah. As Larry the Cable Guy would say. I'm wondering if your whole project was part of a public health preparedness mass immunization project to meet any kind of grant requirement, and if they, you know, favorably looked at what you did, if that met any requirements, you know, if you work in public health or not, because I think it's a great idea. It's the kind of thing that kids think of, and most of us adults don't ever carry out that stuff, but I really got a kick out of your presentation, and I love the idea, because, you know, in an anthrax or some other mass dispensing exercise, we would give family members enough medication for all of, you know, a head of household medication, and it's just brilliant, I think, to give enough flu mist for everybody in the household and say, see you later, because I've actually vaccinated in two different pod events back-to-back where we vaccinated 2,500 people in 4 hours, and I think of what we could have done, you know, if we put these people in rooms like you all did and got them through in chunks like that. Another consideration is maybe have them fill the paperwork out as they're walking in line with their clipboard so that they're continuing to move through if that's feasible. But any other comments you have about funding or grant requirements would be appreciated.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, it's a natural emergency preparedness pursuer. The issue we ran into is that it's not a standard of care. And so from the state level, which is usually where most of our grants, it was basically a non-starter. I sent it on to the state, and to be honest, they never answered me because I think they didn't, it's not they didn't understand, they just didn't know how to answer, right, basically. I think all of your comments are good ones. Trying to get through the paperwork, it was just so artificial because if you're assuming that it's a real event, then you know, you're not going to be doing all of that stuff. It's not going to make any sense. You kind of, you know, defeat the purpose of it. We kind of modified it and tinkered with that as we went along, and we got a lot faster on it. The hard part was that we had to wait for them to come in. You know, when they came in as a group, that was easy to get them all through, but you know, when they're coming in dribs and drabs, that becomes a problem. So when you mentioned anthrax, okay, so if I was to think of a wild out there scenario, I mean, if you look at what people are thinking about nationally in terms of anthrax response, really what they're thinking about is going postal, taking post office and dropping it off at everybody's house. And the advantage to that, to me, in this scenario, the difficulty is you gotta keep the thing cold. The advantage to it is that if you may end up in a scenario wherein you have the vaccine gets there when the flu is here. In fact, that's what, you know, people are wondering if that's gonna happen. And if that's the case, then having large groups of people congregating together like for mass vaccination event is not exactly the smartest thing to do. And people may not wanna do it. And so it thinks, you know, you can conceive of other processes of getting it out to people quickly. Again, that's, you know, several hurdles down the line. But, you know, once you start thinking in these terms, you can think of other ways to use this process, I think.
Okay, great. I think we had three speakers, had time for questions, and ended on time, which is, I think, the first time that I've been involved in such a situation. Let me thank the speakers for three wonderful presentations, thought-provoking presentations. We'll close the session. I just have a few housekeeping announcements that I'll read to you. And one more time, thanks for a great session. So, housekeeping. Good, thanks.